The following podcast is sponsored by SuperheroStuff.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Timothy Harvey, and I am sitting across the room from Mr. Jason Hunt.
Greetings. Hello, hello.
And this is our 76th
yes.
episode of H2O. Yes. We just had our 75th anniversary. Our 75th anniversary. We're very old.
It feels like that sometimes.
Yeah, but no, 75th episode we just did at Kansas City Comic Con.
Yes.
But we are back in the studio, and
with our coffee.
Oh yeah, that was weird being out and like talking about this sort of thing without.
But you know, it was gratifying to see people come out that had never heard the show, never listened to the show. They didn't know who we were, but they came out anyway to see what we were about, and some really good interaction with them and some good questions from everyone. And
you can actually find that on the website.
Yes.
You can listen to your for your very selves.
Yes, and I'm working on the video. I don't know if we're going to post it. We may post a video to YouTube on that one. I'm having some technical pieces where when they brought the extra cord in, the camera goes to the ceiling for a little bit. I'm like, oh, you can hear us talking, but
yeah,
I
understand.
So episode 76.
Yeah, and so what we're going to talk about tonight is this thing that in this wonderful age of genre explosion in the media, there have been many adaptations of some really fantastic source material, and some of it is good and some of it is bad and some of it is different.
And by that you mean the adaptations.
Right. The adaptation has a resemblance to the source material. But not necessarily a particularly close one. For example, I just had a chance to watch the Lucifer pilot, which is leaked onto the interwebs, which premiered at San Diego Comic-Con. The show is not scheduled to come out until next year.
Yeah, it's going to be a mid-season replacement.
Yeah, so I was actually really kind of surprised that we had this had been out there. But on the other hand, studios do that too. That stuff gets out in the world to give you like, oh, that's interesting, that's fun.
Yeah, because we've talked about Supergirl.
Oh yeah,
the fact that the quote unquote leaked pilot is of such high quality. I'm still thinking that CBS put it out there themselves.
Well, and I feel the same way about the Lucifer pilot. It feels it's an HD copy. It's, you know, the effects are all there.
It's a finished piece.
Yeah. So whether or not it's actually officially out there in the world or unofficially out there in the world, it was interesting because I'm a huge fan of the Sandman series by Neil Gaiman, which is the birthplace of the character of Lucifer in the comic. Mm-hmm. In the Vertigo line of comics,
right,
which led to the 75 issues of the Lucifer comic. And when the word came down that they're making a Lucifer TV show on a network.
On Fox.
And we had just been going through the trauma of them finding their way on Constantine and only to have it canceled. There was some concern in my mind, and then I heard it was going to be a police procedural, and I kind of blanked out at that point because I was just like, "Oh, are we serious?"
Yeah. cringe a little bit, did you?
I cringed a lot of it.
Yeah.
And you know, here, folks, if you want to do an adaptation of a comic book series of police procedural, give us Fables.
Oh yeah.
Because you could have a whole arc where Bigby Wolf. Or Big Bad Wolf for you kids at home. He's the sheriff of the town of the Fables. So you just knock yourself out and have your police procedural right there.
Or Gotham Central.
Hey, you know what? Hey, I got this idea for this TV show. I'm pretty sure I'd enjoy watching it a lot more than Gotham, which I have given up on. But actually, Gotham's another case in point. It's something looking at the source material. Mm-hmm. And they go a certain way, And sometimes that can work. You can run with something that is a different, you know, it's based on, but it also has, you know, its own life. And we see this in characters like Philip K. Dick.
Right.
There has never been a straight adaptation of any of his works.
No, no. It's all been based on, but not, or inspired by, right, more than based, right, on.
I mean, if you've ever read Do Androids Dream of Electronic Sheep, having watched Blade Runner, you will be lost. Because they are not, they are, some of the names are the same-ish.
Yeah. Well, The Sentinel.
Oh, yeah.
The short story that was the basis for 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Is, oh, yeah, not entirely the same.
No, no, but being a faithful adaptation doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make a good movie. And there's, you can argue very, very strongly that filming a book as written will not work. You just can't do it.
Right.
And there, that's why we ended up with, David Lynch's Dune, or the Sci-Fi Channel version of Dune, yeah, which was actually both of those miniseries actually were quite good. I was actually very, right, very pleased with them. As far as adaptations are, they were pretty faithful.
Although the Sci-Fi version of Dune was better than Lynch's.
Oh yeah. Well, but
it had the benefit of being longer,
mm-hmm,
which means you've got more room to tell the story.
Sure.
And it's later, which means the technology is better.
Yeah.
That you can do the visual effects better.
But even there, they didn't delve into the politics and the ecology. Because Dune, of course, is, in many ways, you can argue that Dune is very much an ecological novel.
Yeah.
They weren't able to. Because to some degree, it's not gripping television. It's not a gripping film. I mean, yeah, talking political theory or you know, the ecology of a planet, however critical it may be to the story.
This is how democracy ends.
Yeah.
With thunderous applause. Oh, wait.
Yeah. Well, it's like, but you can look at it, and this isn't just limited to you know, science fiction and fantasy. You would never adapt a Tom Clancy novel, you know, the way it's written, because every other, you know, every 10 minutes it would stop to give you a technical manual,
yeah,
on the screen. It just wouldn't work. So you make changes. You have to make changes. But sometimes that can work just fine. And sometimes it's a bloody disaster.
Yes.
And say the first League of Extraordinary Gentlemen movie,
mm-hmm,
which is getting a reboot as a TV series.
Right.
And which they're now calling female-centric, according to the studio.
Which everybody is having a cow about, because it's not the source material. Well, it actually is.
Yeah,
because
if you make Mina Harker the main character.
Which she is in the book.
At least
in the first two books.
Well, especially as you take it all the way through to the end of the entire series. I mean, she really is the core character that everybody revolves around.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, if you just make her the main character and you don't make her a vampire, oh, yeah, way to strip away the compelling backstory of a strong female character in a comic book by turning her into an action figure.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, wow, really?
Well, I mean, adding Tom Sawyer and making him Secret Service agent, same kind of thing.
There's many, many things wrong with that movie. Although, it's pretty.
Yeah, it's nice for what it is, you compare it, and this is one of those things in you know, Fantastic Four, the new Fantastic Four is the same kind of thing, where if you strip away the title and the character names and you put something else on it, you label something else,
sure,
it'd be perfectly fine.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic Four would work perfectly fine as a science fiction film where these four people find a way to split into another dimension and something terrible happens to them and they turn into monsters. That's a film that would work on several levels.
Except it still doesn't have a second act.
Well, no, it doesn't. But you get into the expectations that come attached to the title.
Once you call a thing,
yeah.
Once you name, you know, there's a reason.
And not just Ben Grimm, but anything, I think.
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons that the older audiences necessarily, not necessarily the younger ones, because it's hugely popular and successful films. The older Star Trek fans can have some real issues with the new movies, because it's what? Star Trek.
What new
movies? Yeah, I know. It's Star Trek, but it isn't Star Trek.
Yeah.
And it's like looking at Man of Steel. It's like, hey, it's Superman, but it isn't Superman. And so it becomes this thing where we have ideas of what things are.
Right.
And those are bigger, broader stuff. But yeah, things like the Fantastic Four or...
I think for me, it's a little bit easier to accept a reinvention of Superman than it is for Star Trek. Because with all of the different iterations of Star Trek that we've had over the years, there's mm-hmm. never been a remake. With Superman, you've had... You know, George Reeves, you've had Christopher Reeve, you've had sure. Dean Cain, you've had all these different versions, and he's been rebooted in the pages of the book several times. I mean, the last major one before New 52 being John Byrne's, you know, Man of Steel after Crisis.
86,
I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's easier to sit there and go, okay, they're telling it different. With Star Trek... Not so much. I mean, I get what they tried to do with the time travel to make it part of continuity and nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the same complaint that I have about Kal-El in Man of Steel, is the fact that the character, what makes that character the character we know and love for all of these years, is missing. And it's the same for J.J. Trek, because... Mm-hmm. If you go back and you look at all of the episodes that involve time travel, every single time they figure out whether it's original series or Next Generation or Voyager or any of those. I mean, you look at Yesterday's Enterprise is a great example of that.
Mm-hmm.
City on the Edge of Forever. Every single time that there's time travel and somebody figures out, hey, the timeline's been broken. First thing that they always say is, well, we've got to go fix it. That's every single time. And so it's a consistency thing for me, where you have this core group of people who espouse a certain belief because they're part of Starfleet. You know, it's, I'm painting with a broad brush here.
Right, right.
But when... The scene on the bridge in J.J. Trek 1 where they figure out they're now part of an altered timeline,
mm-hmm.
and Spock walks around the bridge and is like, well, I guess we're stuck in our new timeline. Like, no. No. You're a Vulcan. You're a scientist. You're the one who sits there and says, well, it's broken. We must fix it. You know, or Kirk has to be the, Kirk being the one that has to have the agency, you know, being in command.
Right.
Well, it's broken. We have to go fix it. And none of that was there. And I think when you do any kind of adaptation or a reboot, mm-hmm. You look at, you know, Lucifer or Constantine or Arrow or whatever. If you're doing any kind of an adaptation based on a particular piece of source material, whether it's a book or a comic book or a video game,
mm-hmm.
if you don't get the core of the characters, then you've failed as an adaptation, I think. But that's just me.
Yeah, I think you really have to... there's a balancing act that I think is... Especially when you move to something like television... I mean, movies, it's different because you have a bigger budget.
Right.
And you can fight your way through some of that stuff by throwing money at it. And that's just, you know, if you need an effect, you can do it. For TV, you can't.
Right.
Or you can, but you end up with Once Upon a Time where it's just like a...
Yeah. All green screen.
Oh, God.
Throw an explosion in there.
And it hurts. It hurts. It hurts.
Magic smoke.
Yeah. But so for something like Lucifer, where I think within the first 10 issues, there's a whole little standalone issue where the main character is a centaur. Kind of hard to do on TV. Okay. And we'll do it properly, right?
But if the story is about Lucifer, then you can get away with not telling the centaur story.
Sure, but you also have there's an epic level to the comic. There's big themes. Right. There's stuff that you could get away with, like doing like on a mini series on Showtime or HBO or something like that. Which is why we're going to get something. You know, you're getting some of these shows on cable, where they're playing with some of these bigger, the kind of stuff you can't worry about if you have to worry about advertisers every week.
Yeah.
Or an audience numbers every week, really. You know, you're not. So we're getting these 6-episode, 8-episode bottle shows that, you know, if you have a whole season. You know, you've got your Daredevils on Netflix, and you've got your
Penny
Dreadfuls, True Detective, especially season 1, season 2, such a disappointment, but still.
Yeah.
And I was liking it halfway through, and then it just lost me. But anyway, but still, you get to play with things. You get to you have some freedom on the premium channels you don't have on network.
Right.
So, but something like Lucifer, they've taken enough of the pieces of what made the comic interesting,
yeah,
and given us enough. Okay, unfortunately, it's still a police procedural, and those comic book police procedurals, they have one place. Gotham Central.
but before we started recording, you were saying that you actually ended up liking the pilot.
I did end up liking the pilot, and I was really kind of surprised by that because huge fan of Gaiman's Sandman. Very excited to see, you know, the fact that we have a version of Sandman in production.
Right.
That they are taking their time on. Especially if you wanted to have some fun, go to the internet and look up previous versions, you know, previous attempts to make this film. It's kind of terrifying. But
it's almost as long and convoluted as remaking Superman.
And the thing is, it's even worse because Superman at least has the history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Superman, okay. Yeah. You know, you can argue whatever interpretation you end up with for the character, at least the audience is going to know the character. Sandman is a Vertigo title. So DC Comics, their more experimental line.
Yeah.
Most
people going to the movies are going to know Sandman as Michael Dorn's character from The Santa Claus.
Yeah. Actually.
Sandman? What? He's getting his own movie?
Right. And
it's
so
it's a spinoff?
You're going to have to really sell the audience on just your first trailer is going to have to blow him out of the water. So here you have another character who is even, you know, the Lucifer series is a spinoff.
Right.
Of the Sandman series. So you're recognizing that you're trying to get an audience, you know, to watch a show based on an obscure comic that ran for 75 issues because that's the story he wanted to tell, and then they stopped because we're done,
mm-hmm.
and there has been no sequel. In fact, that version of Lucifer really hasn't even shown up in the New 52, which is a shame because he was more interested in the standard, I am the devil. Okay, you're kind of boring. Go away. Yay. You're evil. Okay, whatever. Yeah. But
stick him on the shelf with all the other evil. Yeah, like right.
The lovely collection of Lords of the Damned, which is a comic. Oh, there's some amazingly bad comic book versions of the devil out there. If you want to, again, to the internet, find all the terrible, terrible versions. But anyway, it's entertaining. It's an entertaining show, and they are clearly having a good time. They have pieces of the main plot from the comic in the pilot, and it is they have a chance to ruin it all because if again it comes down to if the main character if the male lead and the female lead ever get together, this is one of those shows that if they ever get together, it's like
it's done.
No, you broke it.
Well, okay, so let me ask you this then. Given the fact that it is an obscure source material title,
mm-hmm.
are there better or worse chances that it will succeed and find an audience on its own?
Well, I think, oddly enough, there's better chances because considering myself as one of the fans of mm-hmm. Lucifer, the comic, and being part of that contingent who groaned and rolled his eyes when I heard how the show was going to be done. I'm suspecting And this is, you know, one of those grand sweeping statements, which is always unfair to the people you make the grand sweeping statements about. There are a lot of people who are fans of the comic who are looking at this and going, oh,
yeah,
why you got to break our toys? But at the same time, I've been at this long enough. I've been at this, but we do long enough.
Right.
I make movies. I do, I write. I edit. I'm very, very aware how things change. And I think so, how things change because you don't have the money or you don't have access to this thing or that thing. Or you recognize that the medium you're putting something out in has an impact on the story you're telling.
Sure.
And if you're making something for network television, you're not going to be making a big story about predestination and free will, the sweeping nature of good and evil, and, you know, all the different the big themes. That sound, you're not going to do that because it's just, it's not going to play. That's not your audience you're going to find on network TV.
Right.
So you make it, you make something that is going to appeal to a larger audience.
Sure.
And for the fans, you sit there and go, we left this in. We got this. We like the characters too, but we, you know, this is the realities that we're doing.
Yeah.
I think it has a better chance of succeeding with a larger audience than if they were to just target it at the fans. You know, I have no idea what the Vertigo numbers, what the numbers were for Lucifer, but I guarantee you it wasn't, you know, in the millions and millions of right. readers.
Well, and it's like anything else that we've talked about, and when you compare the audience for films versus the audience for comic books,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're talking 2, 3, 4, 5 million people seeing these movies worldwide, whereas with comic books, you're probably at best 250, 300,000 people,
right.
maybe 350,000.
Right.
And so it's not going to be a big, your core audience for whatever title it is, whether mm-hmm. it's Lucifer, Green Arrow, Constantine, or any of those, is not going to be as big, and therefore, in the rational business mind,
mm-hmm.
it's not as important an audience. Even though they are the most vocal, especially when you get it wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And we see this with Fantastic Four, where the word of mouth early, you know, combined with all of the rumors and the hearsay and the he said, she said, and whatever we were hearing coming from the set,
mm-hmm.
killed that movie.
Oh, yeah.
It never had a chance.
No, it really didn't.
And it's interesting that it did as badly as it did, even though it's not a terrible film.
No, it's not. It's not awful.
But I have to wonder how much of the bad press and how much of the negative buzz and the rumors and all of that, how much of that was deliberate? How much of this movie are we seeing another Corman Fantastic Four where
we're going to make it
just to make it, get it out there, and we'll go ahead and release this one so we don't have people screaming for it for the next 25 years to see it?
I would say probably not, just because of the sheer amount of money involved.
Because Constantine Films is still involved.
Yeah.
Because I saw, it was funny because James and I sat and we watched the Corman one Saturday morning. And then in the afternoon, we went and saw the new one.
Sure.
And the first title, 20th Century Fox, Constantine Films.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, they are still involved. After all this time, they're still involved in this thing. And so that kind of tipped me off right there, thinking, well, wait a minute. Maybe this thing's not supposed to make money. Maybe it's not supposed to succeed.
It's a lot of money to intentionally throw down a well, though.
Wouldn't be the first time.
I know. But it's...
I mean, Disney killed John Carter.
Yeah. I'm aware that the studios are often run by people who are less concerned with actually, you know, getting the film out than killing the film that they didn't want made.
Right.
But at the same time...
And, you know, and there's nothing that says they can't take the loss.
Oh, yeah,
you know, true. It's a tax thing. Oh, it's a write-off. We just lost the money. We'll write it off.
But I think the it still ends up being a black eye for them. And yeah. I think on a PR level, it's not the best of decisions. And I think that that really kind of makes me think that it was not intended to be quite this of a big of a disappointment. But they did something that was especially with this. Okay, so we have this Fantastic Four is a fairly faithful adaptation of Ultimate Fantastic Four.
Right.
And that may have been the real problem.
I think it was one of them. I think you're talking about as the source material choice.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not so much the best idea.
Right, because again, for your larger audience, your Fantastic Four is the grown-ups, bright costumes
from 1963. Yeah.
And I still mean, I believe very, very strongly that what the Fantastic Four movie needs to be a set in the past of the Marvel Universe.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have, you know, the first Ant-Man and Wasp cross paths with these guys. And, you know, and then later you have them show up as older characters in the universe. And, right. And,
yeah, because you were talking about that on Level 1187.
Yeah, I think it'd be a great idea.
Which is our Marvel podcast.
Right.
Which you can hear on a weekly basis starting on September 29th when Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. comes back.
That's right.
So there.
Yeah.
I got to get that in, you know, cross promotion.
But I think that it's you run a risk when you are playing against the general public's expectations.
Right.
Right or wrong, okay? And it's not just us. It happens in other countries as well. Attack on Titan came out in Japan not too long ago. Two blisteringly bad reviews.
Yeah.
So much so that the creator of Attack on Titan has asked fans to explain why they're so angry.
Oh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they'd like to understand. Well, and pretty much the reviews are all pretty clear. You changed the story too much. And
gee, imagine that.
Yeah, no. They're kind of like, huh, this isn't what we signed up for. This isn't what we wanted. And some of it is practical. The characters in the comic are German. It's the last enclave of humanity. It's actually set in Germany, and they didn't go out and the Japanese filmmakers did not go out and get a bunch of German actors. They cast it with Japanese actors.
Oh,
well, that's
sure
clearly, you know, a logical financial reason, and not to mention a good, you know, employer own actors reason. That's right. not a bad idea, but. Okay, so you're changing the characters. All right, that's fine. Whatever. But then they apparently kept changing too many of the characters. Characters' motivations, characters' backstories, all this stuff is kind of going out the window. And fans sat there and went, okay, so why are we calling it Attack on Titan again? And yeah, so it's huge, and it hasn't even opened here.
Right, I didn't even realize it was complete.
Yeah, so, well, there's also an Attack on Titan TV show that's in development.
Right. Yeah,
so.
But I knew we'd had some trailers come out for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that it was done.
Yeah.
Finished.
Yeah. Well, and now it's raising some questions because I guess one of the guys involved with producing the film or directing the film is doing the next Toho Godzilla.
Ooh.
And people are going, are we sure? So yeah, it's become this
thing. It could be another Josh Trank.
Yeah, well, and that's I've seen some people defending him, saying that he's really, really good with the physical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, if Godzilla's got to have the physical stuff,
Godzilla is nothing if not physical.
Right. So, yeah. But still, so it becomes this thing where you have a source material that is beloved.
Yeah.
And then the adaptation just isn't right.
Well, it's like Akira. We keep hearing about this.
We keep being threatened with.
Yeah, this new version of Akira set in a futuristic New York instead of Tokyo. And really,
well, the thing is that Josh Trank already made that movie. We call it Chronicle. that's the American Akira.
Yeah,
It's a different scale.
Right.
But, you know, okay, that's a fantastic example of something that if you pull something out of its context, there's a reason Akira makes it is important, because Japan was the country we dropped the atomic bomb on.
Right.
Okay. If you pull that history out, if the history, the backstory isn't there, and sorry, folks, September 11th is not going to be the same thing.
No.
That's the closest thing the States has got, and as much of a tragedy and a horrible, horrible thing, it's not the same. That's the only thing I was thinking about that the other day. It's the only thing I could think of that they would sit there and go, and then this happened, and it's like, oh, it's not the same.
Unless they set it far enough into the future that they could make up something that happened.
Yeah, but if you're going to build that much of a future world, just go shoot it in Japan and give us a really amazing live action Akira made with a Japanese production company. And
well, Godzilla is the same way. You take it. I mean, the reason we have a Godzilla movie in the first place is because of the bombs.
Oh yeah,
and that whole nuclear proliferation. Mm-hmm. Thing that was part of that story.
Well, and I think that what they did right with the American Godzilla was that they still managed to tie it into the threat of atomic
right.
death. But it also made Godzilla almost more of a force of nature, as opposed to, you know, and certainly Godzilla can have that role in the Japanese films.
Right.
But that was kind of really a lot more, you know, prevalent in the American version. And of course, mostly just people came to see monsters fighting.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is a perfectly acceptable reason to go see a movie.
It is. And on that note, we're going to take a break here, let you hear from our sponsors, including superherostuff.com. They do have some Godzilla stuff.
They do.
And other licensed merchandise. We'll let you hear from them. And we will be back talking faithful and not so faithful adaptations. Do they work? Do they not work? And why? And all that good stuff when H2O continues. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to H2O on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Where can you get Age of Ultron stuff?
SuperheroStuff.com.
Where can you get Justice League stuff?
SuperheroStuff.com.
Where can you get Doctor Who stuff?
SuperheroStuff.com.
Where can you get Daredevil stuff?
SuperheroStuff.com.
New items being added all the time. Get your superhero stuff at SuperheroStuff.com. Plus, the Hero Box is back. $70 worth of superhero stuff for only $49. SuperheroStuff.com, where heroes shop.
Atomic Cotton, where Erica and Zach combine their passion for art and film to create wearable art. All original, made with a love for the genre. Coming to a convention near you very soon. Or find them on the web at atomiccotton.com. Atomic Cotton. Shirts and art for fans by fans.
Hi, this is Jason Hunt, and if you're one of the dedicated listeners for this show, first of all, thank you. Second, you are sharing with others, are you not? And you should be aware by now, we have many shows as part of Sci-Fi for Me Radio. Our Marvel discussion on Level 117, the DC chat on the Rogues Gallery, Sci-Fi for Chicks talking about various topics, which we also do in mixed company on the Echo Chamber, and H2O, which is our one-on-one discussion between Mr. Harvey and myself, now syndicated over at Amazing Stories Magazine. Sci-Fi for Me Radio is more than one show, and we'd like to invite you to join us for all of it, or at least try it out and see what you think. And also check out Sci-Fi for Me TV. That's our YouTube channel where we have interviews, convention panel video, and Week in Review, where we deliver a digest of the news of the week. All part of giving you the most bang for your buck. Oh yeah, wait, no, it's free. So check it out. Sci-Fi for Me Radio and Sci-Fi for Me TV. All part of SciFiForMe.com, your portal to the science fiction multiverse.
You're listening to Sci-Fi for Me Radio because it's the second best invention in the history of the world.
And we are back. I am Timothy Harvey, and I'm sitting across the room from Mr. Jason Hunt.
Hello.
And we are discussing adaptations in the genre world and the
matters of faith.
Matters of faith.
Faithful adaptations.
That's right. So we've talked about several the front part here. So things like the new Lucifer show. You have TV shows like Constantine, which got more faithful the further they went on.
Right.
Unfortunately, not enough to save it. You have shows like Gotham, which is
not
remotely faithful to the source material, although it seems to have a lot of the same names.
Yeah.
And some of the same characters. There's some good performances over on Gotham. I'm not a fan of the show. It's lost me, I admit it. but there are some good performances over there, and it is a
It's a show
with things that happen. But I mean, you look at things like Arrow and The Flash. They are faithful to a degree,
right?
So when we do get something like that promotional art where Flash of Two Worlds,
yes,
and we see it is a pretty faithful recreation of the original comic art, and the costume for the Earth 2 Flash is the costume.
Yes. And it's very exciting.
And the fans just sit there and go, that's amazing and wonderful. It's like Christmas. You know? And for the general audience, for the bigger audience, it's not necessarily a big deal. But the people who are creating the shows, those shows are fans of the shows. They're of the comics. They're fans of the characters.
And they understand the characters. Mm-hmm. They understand what it is they're fans of.
Right. So when they do make those changes for the medium.
Yeah.
When you sit there and go, okay, I really can't have a show where Barry Allen is the only person who knows Barry's secret, and I gotta build a team around Barry Allen. They build a team around Barry Allen that actually is entertaining to watch, plays the larger mythology, and gives us a villain who we all find ourselves kind of rooting for, because Tom Cavanaugh did a fantastic job. And you can do something like over on Arrow, where you pull in a villain who is not really part of the Arrow's rogues gallery.
Well, hardly any of them. Because and it's funny because I saw an interview with, was it Guggenheim? I think it was Mark Guggenheim, talking about the fact that there were so many Batman villains coming in, mm-hmm. you know, being pulled into Arrow. And he was saying, well, really, Arrow doesn't have a deep bench of villains. You've got Count Vertigo, and you've got Malcolm Merlyn.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, there's really not any other major villain in the Green Arrow universe.
Right.
So
and
much.
You're not going to.
Helgramite, maybe.
The ones that you find. And there are plenty of interesting Green Arrow villains, but they're not necessarily good TV villains. They're not necessarily good movie villains. If you were to ever do a adaptation of the Longbow Hunters, mm-hmm. the series, the Mike Grell kind of revival that kind of brought Green Arrow back into the comic book consciousness, he'd kind of faded off quite a bit.
Because he's just a ripoff of Batman.
Yeah, well, this was
a lot of people.
This rooted him very much in. It was actually one of the better series to take a character and push him darker.
Mm-hmm.
Because he looked out there and went, well, let's see, he's a guy running around with a bow, and arrows are sharp. You realize he's hurting people, right?
Yeah.
And so they played with the logical extension of that. And Mike Grell's a good writer. It's also one of those series that is really, would be really hard to adapt now. It would upset a lot of people.
Because it's too dark, or because it's just more grimdark like everything else?
It goes someplace with the character of Black Canary that is... it's implied very strongly that she's raped. And...
What is it nowadays?
But that's back then. This is the 80s. This was the late 80s.
Yeah, but still, I mean... I don't know. I mean, you know, because we talked about this with Jessica Jones.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that now, and you made a point there about the Purple Man having raped her,
right.
even though Bendis has said it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's implied, and a lot of people assume that it happened.
Right.
But the writer of the series says, no, he didn't. But, you know, what are you going to do? It's like the end of The Killing Joke.
Mm-hmm.
Did Batman kill the Joker or not?
Right. Well, unfortunately, what ends up happening is that when, as a creator, when you put something out into the world, interpretation is in the hands of your audience.
Right.
And if you set it up that the most logical, for the majority of people, or even a sizable chunk of people, if the place that the imagery takes them is to go,
mm-hmm.
that's sticking. Yeah. And it becomes...
But see, I never... Because we're getting an adaptation. We're going to get an animated adaptation of The Killing Joke next year.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have the question. Again, it'll come up mm-hmm. because it's at the end of this thing. Does Batman kill the Joker?
See, I never saw him.
I never saw it.
I understand how they get there, but mm-hmm. I never saw it either.
Yeah. Now, Grant Morrison is the one that put this out, I think, on... Because he was talking to Kevin Smith on the Smodcast.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where it first got traction.
Mm-hmm.
And then people latched onto it and they thought, but they see it. Now they can't unsee it.
Right. And if you look at it, it's kind of an A to B to C
right.
to D
it's
to
an
E.
Easy, yeah. It's an easy conclusion to draw once you're primed to draw
sure.
it.
Sure.
I don't think if you just look at it, oh, okay, well, all the sound cuts off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just the laughter. I mean, the siren's gone. Everything. I mean, that last panel is blank.
Right. Well, so. I think that for something like, say, The Longbow Hunters, where the scene, the way the art is framed,
mm-hmm.
it's very clear in the context of the story that she's been physically tortured.
Right.
But what's happened to her clothes and all this stuff? It's not a sexualized image.
Right.
But it's a very vulnerable woman in
peril,
very little clothing,
right?
Image, and I can it that was very much why a lot of people made that connection.
Sure.
Now, the problem with doing, say, an adaptation of that is that you couldn't do it in the Arrow universe for TV.
No,
it wouldn't fit.
No,
because we've already had an Oliver who kills. Because up until this point in the comic book, Green Arrow really was not much of a killer.
There was that one during Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams' run
mm-hmm.
where he is, I mean, it was dark alley and he's shooting. Mm-hmm. I have this still somewhere. He's firing his arrow mm-hmm. at the guy with the sniper,
mm-hmm.
you know, and of course he's aiming for the gun
mm-hmm.
and accidentally hits the guy and kills
right.
him. And immediately breaks the bow. Quits
mm-hmm.
and goes off to a monastery.
Right.
Because he's killed a guy.
Right.
And he was horrified mm-hmm. that he'd killed someone because he had a twinge in his shoulder. He was injured.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an accident. He didn't mean to kill him. Okay.
Right.
And, you know, we get that. And that's the setup. But he immediately quits.
Right. Whereas with,
done finished.
Whereas with Grell asked the question, where would Oliver have to go to be someone who would kill without a thought.
Right.
He would just, this is how I solve the problem. And so he took him there. And it's so it fits in continuity. You basically have Oliver has no interest in being the kind of vigilante who leaves a trail of bodies. And by the end of this, you can see him going, no, sometimes you have to put them down.
Yeah.
And we already had that on Arrow, right?
Right.
And so if you're to build it in the larger DC.
And actually, you had it in reverse on Arrow because
exactly.
that's where he started.
Right. Which,
and he's pulling back from it.
Which
that.
Is honestly is a very. It's that's more compelling to me than somebody who starts off with the noble intentions and becomes darker.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather see somebody who recognizes that they can pull back, and that makes them more of a hero.
Like Darth Vader.
Which Darth Vader?
The real one.
The real one?
The real one. The one who came back from his dark place.
That's and, right. You know, that's right. In the final minutes of the third of the only three films.
That's right.
But
four if you count the new one.
Right. That's right. There's a new one. It looks good. I've seen
it
trailers.
It does.
Well, and that's something else is that you know, there's if it was not this, if we were looking at a Star Wars maybe 10 years down the line, 15 years down the line, I don't know that we would have. First of all, we'd be aging ourselves out of the original cast.
Yeah,
Peter Mayhew does not look good.
He's moved around better since he got his knee surgery.
Oh, good, good,
yeah.
good. Because he was
That's what I heard.
I was. It was. he's such a neat guy, and it was so painful to watch him.
And I did read that there were some places in the new one where they have somebody else in the costume, mm-hmm. but for all the important Chewbacca stuff, it's
okay.
him.
Okay. Yeah. But it's you know, if you were to like reboot Star Wars, it would be hard. It would be really hard for audiences to take that. Because it's culturally, it's rooted there. It's part of the American psyche, in a way that very few pieces of entertainment really are.
Right.
Even though we've been rebooting, you know, King Arthur and Robin Hood and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, forever.
I don't know that you could reboot Star Wars.
Well, luckily, we don't have to find out. Because I think, look, 20, 30 years from now, if this version of Star Wars somehow doesn't take off, if this continuation of the original story for some reason crashes and burns, I know. I don't see
the
that.
The words coming out of your mouth just sound like,
wah, wah, I know. Wah, wah. It's this is almost an impossibility. But if it did, if for any reason, I think
Star Wars, The Force Awakens, will probably be the first movie to cross 3 billion the first weekend. I mean, it's just going to get all the monies that weekend.
I'm not sure the economy can take it. I think there's going to be everybody's broke, but the studio has all the money. It's just like,
yeah, let's go buy a small country.
Exactly. Yeah. Small country. Let's go buy France.
That's probably who'd want it.
Great wine. The cheese is lovely as well. And Paris is pretty. But the thing is that if we didn't have this, if we did not have this opportunity to have the story, they would. They would reboot it.
Yeah, eventually they probably would.
And it would.
Because that's what we do now.
Yeah.
Everything's a reboot.
But again, it's not a new thing.
I know. It's not a new thing.
We just notice it more because it's bigger and it has more.
I don't know that we notice it more so much the fact that everything now is a reboot.
Yeah, there's a lot of that too.
You know, it's the frequency of it that I think people are getting tired of. It's like, okay, yeah, fine. Wizard of Oz in 1939 was a remake.
Yeah.
Maltese Falcon was a remake. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. But you didn't have 50 other remakes in production that same year.
Right. This is very true. But okay, so you have the Red is coming to TV. They're doing a Red TV series. And for those of you who did not see the Red films, shame on you. They're a lot of fun. But they're not actually very faithful adaptations of the source material.
Right.
Because when you have a chance to get a bunch of your actors in their 50s and 60s to come out and play at being aging assassins, you run with the ridiculous possibilities if you are smart, because it's fun.
Yeah, sure.
Right? So the comic book is darker and it's not quite as, it's not quite as silly at places, but I wouldn't trade a second of it, because something about watching, you know, that particular cast,
right?
You know, poking fun at the fact that they are, you know, not as young as they used to be, and they're kind of playing the parts that they, in many ways, playing parts that they played when they were younger, and to some characters, especially Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's an adaptation that works, whereas The Losers. Is a fairly faithful adaptation of the comic book, and it did not do well in theaters at all.
No.
And I love that movie. I laughed myself through that film so hard.
I seem to recall that when The Losers came out, there was another movie that was out about the same time that was something similar that came out first.
It was called The A-Team.
Was it? Was that
I
the
think
same?
I can't remember which one came out first.
I think the A-Team came out and then The Losers came out. I think you're right. I think they were both within a couple of 2-3 weeks of each other.
And the A-Team was just awful.
Terrible.
And
there's an adaptation. We've been talking mostly about comic book to movies, but TV show to movie. The Man from U.N.C.L.E. is getting, it's okay. It's not getting gangbuster reviews. There are some that saying, yeah, it's a lot of fun, but it would have been nice if Guy Ritchie and the gang had actually watched the TV show. You know, I mean, I'm seeing that.
Well, but I think again, you have, okay. So in the same vein, Okay, you had the Avengers, not the comic book heroes, but the TV show Avengers, right,
yeah,
the British.
John Steed John and Emma Peel.
Emma Peel, with arguably a fantastic cast.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Ray Fiennes and Uma Thurman.
And Sean Connery.
And Sean Connery. Would have been a great combination.
Oh, yeah, if only they'd had a good script.
Yeah.
Which they did not.
Well, Green Hornet, same way.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everybody was so excited because we were getting a Green Hornet movie.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, who's making it again?
Well, but some of those same people are behind the Preacher adaptation,
which we've still not seen anything of.
I know.
So, it's too soon to tell whether or not that's going to be a decent one or not.
Well, but that's another one where, just like Lucifer, mm-hmm. you're playing with themes. Okay, let's say it. There's a reason why the TV show Lucifer has already had some people protesting about it.
Right.
Okay. The devil is being painted as
the hero,
a sympathetic character,
sure.
If not a hero, certainly a sympathetic character. Some people have an issue with that. Preacher is going to offend large chunks of people who are not going to get the joke, I guess, or not going to get the bigger questions being asked, because it's you have to stare at the comic book long enough to get what they're talking about. You have
right.
to you have to have multiple issues to follow. There are themes mm-hmm. here.
Sure,
it's not just a guy. It's not just a southern preacher who gets the power of the voice of God and decides he's going to hunt down God and get answers. And along the way, really terrible things happen. It's going to upset people.
Yeah.
If they do it right. If they do a faithful adaptation, it's going to upset people. And it's going to be a blast to watch if they do it right.
Uh-huh.
But it's going to upset folks. I mean, it's one of those things where the comic book upset people. But again, your readership was so... It was another Vertigo title. So you had this narrow and loyal readership.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to be one of those things where if they consider changing it to not upset people, they will lose a lot of what made the source material work.
Yeah.
Now there aren't that many comics out there right now that are in that category that have any kind of footprint that I can think of. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I'm not coming off the top of my head. I can't think of anything.
Vertigo, and one of the reasons that some of us miss the glory days of Vertigo so much is that they were really interested in telling really complex, difficult stories. Mm. And they let them do it. They let the creators run. I mean, Neil, that was
before the current regime.
Oh yeah, well that was
DC.
That was the '80s, and that was the '80s.
That was Paul Levitz.
That was
Paul Levitz and Jeanette Kahn.
Eighties and the early '90s, yeah. where your glory days, where you had Shade the Changing Man, and you had Sandman, and you had
Hellblazer,
and things like that, where you were able to sit there and go, okay, I'm going to tell a story about da da, and they sat there and went, all right. Go tell your story. We will wait here and wait for the fans.
There's how much blood?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much ink? What are our printing costs going to be? Oh, man. Okay, fine. Can you have a little less blood? Can we make it? All right, never mind. Good. Yeah. Go. Yeah. Right. So, I'm going to be very curious what they do with it, because you can, if you're not worried about that. If your concern is just to tell a good story
mm-hmm.
and be a good adaptation, then I think people will forgive a lot of questionable content, because there's an audience for challenging stories. There's an audience who's going to be upset about everything.
Well, and we're going to get a little bit of that with Jessica Jones,
yeah.
because it's going to be, you know, darker psychologically mm-hmm. than even Daredevil.
Well, and I think that because they did it on Netflix, Marvel had the ability to go much darker than their Marvel universe.
Right. Even though they're still not going into R-rated territory.
Right.
Because we've already seen as well with the Punisher
mm-hmm.
that it's not going to go quite that dark that you would normally expect with that character.
Right, and I think that's probably okay too, because they are aware that their audience has a younger component. Mm. You do have to, if you don't, but at the same time, your younger component. If your folks are letting you watch shows like, you know, Daredevil,
and if you're letting your kid watch something like Daredevil, why?
Yeah, how old is your kid exactly? Ugh. You know, but we also have, you know, there's a younger audience for shows like The Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. Which, as an adaptation of the comic book, is diverged.
It's kind of a mixed bag for you guys, though, because you know there were several seasons there where you were hate watching it because it just wasn't any good.
Right. Well, it becomes. I think that was definitely a translation issue in some cases.
By the way, folks, Team Zombie does do recaps of The Walking Dead.
I know, and Fear the Walking Dead.
Fear the Walking Dead is coming soon. What,
very
in
soon.
The next like, couple of weeks,
I think it's like this week. I think we're within a week.
Okay.
It might be Sunday. I gotta look that up. Oh wow.
Yeah, because you guys are doing recaps.
That's
for
right.
Have y'all figured out what you're gonna do with it yet?
No. It's for our usual method has been complicated by the fact that Dustin is a father now. So.
Yeah.
And my kid is full grown, so I don't have to worry about her. She's off doing her own thing. So, but yeah, it becomes one of those moments where you're looking at a show where they are being sometimes very faithful to the comic, and sometimes being wildly unfaithful. And it works in some cases because some of the characters, certainly the TV version of the character, say Carol,
right,
is far more interesting and far more developed than the comic character was. Whereas the character,
well, and Daryl isn't even part of the comic book,
right,
isn't he?
Right. And they're, well, they have said over and over again they're going to bring him into the comic. They haven't done it. I think it's just talk.
I think I saw something where Kirkman said it's never going to happen.
Yeah. I think that's the more accurate answer than the various scuttlebutt rumor things we've been getting over the last couple of years. But the character of
oh, speaking of which,
yeah,
did you see? I don't know if you saw this or not. I ran across a real quick thing. I think it popped up on either Facebook or Twitter.
Mm.
Blaster.
Yeah.
had a piece. And it was one of these things where I guess different people were writing about different shows that they missed or something. Mm-hmm. But there was this very, very short paragraph that said the CW was bringing back Young Justice.
Oh,
and
yeah.
they had already completed seasons 3 and 4 and were working on season 5. And everybody just went, huh? What? Huh? Could it be true? Huh? What? So I'm following Greg Weissman on Twitter, and it's due diligence. I'm not going to post something like that and say, hey, guess what? And I went to put the link to show it, and it was gone. That paragraph was already gone.
Yeah.
And so I sent a note to him. I was like, I'm seeing this. Is there anything to it? I was like, no. I said, Blaster says CW is bringing back Young Justice. He goes, lies.
I know.
See, right? It's a disappointment.
Well, because things like like in the comic book universe, you have these multiple realities. You have these different versions. You're able to do a version of Young Justice that didn't exactly match the ones in the comic, and that's all. Yeah. That's your hand waving answer.
It's your multiverse.
It's Earth, whatever. But that was a really, really good adaptation of many of the comic book characters.
Oh yeah, very solid.
And played with themes that were worked with younger audiences and older audiences. And if you were a fan of the comic books, you were getting a lot of little moments. And if you weren't a fan, this is an introduction.
But it didn't sell enough toys
to the right people.
Right.
Girls buy stuff too.
They do.
It's true.
Yeah.
But it becomes this interesting thing because I keep using that phrase. It becomes this thing. I'm not sure why that one popped up so much.
Because it's a thing.
Well,
and it's like anything else. It goes back to something that we've talked about numerous times, the story. Whether you're telling an adaptation or an original piece, but especially if it's an adaptation, if you're faithful or not, depending on which direction you want to go, if the story is still compelling enough to draw that audience in and to keep them there, then I think it's going to be a success. Otherwise, if you do something like Man of Steel, where you completely gut what makes that character the character, you're going to lose a lot of people.
Yeah, and
it's going to be interesting to see how Batman V Superman does, because you've basically gutted Superman.
Well, you've got to get it back. You have that's the point. If you don't bring that, and this is, you know, like I said, I've maintained since for a while now that we have to have that scene where he says this will never happen again.
Yeah,
and if we don't have it, you've got this giant gaping hole in the character that is going to be really hard to fill for many, many people. But you also have, say, the new Man in the High Castle series.
Yeah.
Which, from the pilot, is pretty faithful. And I think in many ways it might be the most faithful adaptation of Dick we've gotten.
But how well do you think it's going to do?
Well, was there four or five different series that they threw against the wall and asked the fans to vote for?
Yeah.
And that really got the lion's share of the positive fan reactions. So it may, they're also dealing with a smaller audience. They're not too worried about having giant numbers.
Well, because the other thing too is you know, with any of these properties, with the smaller, lesser known properties, your audience is going to be considerably smaller anyway.
You know,
regardless of what medium you're adapting it to.
Which is a really sad thing to say, that your Philip K. Dick audience is going to be your potentially smaller audience. But in a way, it is the case.
Yeah. Well, it's like anything else. You know, it was like what we talked about here a while back, where Greg Cox was watching Geeks at Drink, and nobody knew.
Right.
Nobody knew who'd written iRobot. We're in that place now, where even if it's an adaptation, the younger group is not going to know the original source material as readily.
Childhood End is coming out. And
they're doing another Brave New World.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to know the source material.
Brave New World, you might still have some high schools still having them read it. Because that was where I actually first read Brave New World.
Yeah.
But,
well, The Martian Chronicles.
When
that miniseries came out on, where was it, on ABC or NBC with Rock Hudson?
Yeah.
You remember that?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I watched
it. How many people had read that book then?
But you know what? That actually had a built-in audience, I think, much of, because we're
Rock
all,
Hudson.
Well, we're also looking at a time, and it's actually not a very good adaptation.
Yeah.
Visually, it's very interesting, but it's not a very good adaptation.
It's not faithful.
No, it's not faithful at all. In a way, it was simpler then, because there were less avenues. Okay, so you had television,
true.
You had movies, but TV. Yeah. There were three channels in PBS, and movies played in theaters a lot longer.
Yeah,
and so you had a lot more people who were reading books, But again, we're also looking at a smaller niche audience, because science fiction was sort of "quote unquote" disreputable. You know, it's not important literature; it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
and we all knew that wasn't the case. But there was a perception for some people, not everyone, of course. But
do you read that? Those kind of books?
Why aren't you reading something important? But same thing. It was the same thing with mystery novels, and there really wasn't a horror.
Yeah.
Genre. I mean, there was, but it wasn't anything like what we see now. For like, go to a bookstore, there's a horror section. You didn't really have that back
it was all mixed in there with everything else.
So it becomes it's a thing that is becoming. But you have adaptations of TV shows that are adaptations of other TV shows. So how many different versions of Knight Rider have crashed and burned?
Well, you had the cartoon.
Oh,
you
God.
Had the
was
new version.
There was never a cartoon. There was never a cartoon.
Okay. Well, I don't think you count the I don't think you count the Hasselhoff TV movies, because those technically weren't reboots, they were sequels.
Right, sure.
So really one reboot.
Yeah.
You know,
okay, yeah, but
Bionic Woman.
Sure.
Bionic Woman is another one where it was not faithful. But again, that goes back to like Fantastic Four. If you take the name off and you rename the character to something completely new and brand new and different, then it would have done okay.
Well, but interestingly enough, of course, $6 Million Man was not a faithful adaptation of Cyborg.
Right.
Which was,
and it's going to be interesting to see what the movie does, because the $6 Billion Man with Mark Wahlberg, is that going to be more Cyborg, or is it going to be more $6 Million Man?
As long as they don't make it more Dukes of Hazzard, this horrible, you know, there's, well, okay. For the kids at home, if you are looking at a source material from the 70s or early 80s, and you find it to be very, very kitschy, very, very silly, very, very, God, that's really cheesy.
It's only because you don't understand it.
Well, it's only because you don't understand what television was like then.
Right.
And just because you're laughing at it now doesn't mean it was meant to be a comedy, or a comedy like you think it should be now. Studios, listen up. Do not keep turning TV shows that were not comedies or slapstick comedies into stupid slapstick comedies.
So, yeah, Starsky and Hutch was not anything like Starsky and Hutch.
There's only been one that worked. Dragnet. And Dragnet only worked. Dragnet only worked because of the cast.
Yeah.
And, it's a very flawed movie. But of all of them, all the adaptations, all the ones that sit there and treat it as a comedy, probably the only one that worked.
I see the Dragnet, I see the Dan Aykroyd Dragnet as a parody. Well, more than an adaptation, more than a reboot.
Well, but the thing is that you can't look at, come on.
I mean,
Starsky and Hutch is a parody.
Starsky and Hutch.
It's so a parody. No. It's not an intentional parody. They're trying to make a comedy
that's
movie.
That's true.
But it's a parody of its source material.
Yeah.
And Dukes of Hazzard was a parody of its source material.
Brady Bunch.
At least Brady Bunch, the premise of the TV show was, then the TV show itself was fairly ludicrous. There were some areas to mind there. I watched the first Brady Bunch movie kind of under protest.
I didn't see
the second one.
I didn't either. There's so many different things, the ways you could go with that, because does a parody count as an adaptation? I don't think it does.
I guess it depends on whether or not it's a parody made with a certain amount of respect for the original, and you can do that. I mean, you can have a parody that.
Well, because Ben Stiller, talked about how much he loves Starsky and Hutch, and really, I got to give him his props, because his performance as David Starsky is really, really close to Paul Michael Glaser. I mean, you can see it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yes, he is Starsky, except it's a parody of Starsky. It's an over-exaggerated Starsky. And I thought, if they played it straight and didn't make Hutch a pothead, it would have worked so much better for me, personally.
I think the studios don't necessarily know. When we talked about this before, that studios are run by people our age now.
Yeah.
And a little bit older.
And they're hanging on to their youth.
And but they're looking at their youth through.
They're clinging to their youth.
But they're looking at not the same eyes that they were looking at when they were in that youth.
Right. Exactly.
And so you have something like the V reboot. Remember the V reboot?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Painfully.
There is something there. There's the gems of a solid reinterpretation of that story, but they just didn't figure out how to work it. They didn't understand.
That reboot lost me in the first episode.
Oh, I think I made it five or six in before I just washed my hands of it and walked away. I, Marina Bakarin, I can look at her for days. But there's no point.
It's a pretty cast, yeah. But there's no substance.
Right.
And it's not V.
Well, your original V miniseries was an occupation story. It's the Nazis. And if you...
And you can't tell that story now because it's not politically correct.
Well, you can. You can. The thing is, though, you have to figure out how to do it without being blatant. Because then, even then, mm-hmm. it wasn't, and now, introducing the space Nazis. It was, I mean, it was
now
there.
That's Iron Sky.
Yeah, exactly. And see, and that at
which
least
is on Netflix.
That at least wears its crazy lunacy on its sleeve and runs with it. For a lot of the audience, it took them a little while. Over those couple of nights, mm-hmm. especially when you got into the character, the older Jewish characters.
Yeah.
Once that clicked, everyone sat there and went, oh. And you could do that now. You could do that. There's still something to be said because you don't have to worry about offending the Germans. The Germans are keenly aware of their history.
Yeah.
And they are not, and they are the biggest critics of their own history when it comes to that. They, you know, it's still a national subject of national shame for the vast majority of Germans and people who never were alive during World War II, because they understood what it was. You could still do that story. You could still do a very much a Nazi allegory, but you would actually have to be willing to go to the pogroms and the concentration camps and the darker places that we kind of don't want to go because it makes us all very uncomfortable.
I mean, you had pieces of that in the original V miniseries and the Final Battle miniseries.
And it maybe
was there.
And I think they pulled back because of restrictions on what you could do on television. There's places you couldn't go.
Yeah, because the TV series was nothing like the minis.
No.
And it lost a lot of its effectiveness, I thought, because they got lighter.
Well, it got lighter, and you couldn't...
And your budget was smaller.
Oh, yeah, recycled effects, wow.
Yeah.
That was a terrible, terrible, terrible recycled effects. But yeah, you couldn't... It's hard to maintain that story unless you're willing to go along with them with... Maybe tracing along where the real world went, mm-hmm. which is it is one of the darkest periods of our mucking around with each other on this planet.
Yeah,
it's kind of awful what we did, what people were doing. But so you could do it, but I think that it would be asking the audience to go to darker places than we like to go, even with shows like Hannibal on the Air, where they go pretty dark places, and some of these other shows where you can go really dark. That's something that even if you...
Well, you're on cable then.
Oh, yeah. You're on cable. But you're also... I don't know. You could do it. I don't want someone to remake V, though.
No.
I want them to do something else. I want them to tell an original story.
Oh, bite your tongue.
It can happen.
Nobody does anything original anymore.
Someday they will bring me an original science fiction series.
Maybe one of these days we'll write one.
Well, we will. But you know what? We're kind of getting some of that stuff, oddly enough, out of a network that I've heard of that shows wrestling, things like that. There's some wrestling channel that wants to make some original science fiction program. Oh, wait.
We'll have to go check that out.
I've heard tell...
Oh.
There's a lot of stuff we didn't cover, but there's so much out there. I mean, there's...
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's in general, I think we've pretty much come to the conclusion that, you know, it boils down to story.
It really does.
Whatever, you know, how many of our episodes have been, you know...
Story?
Yeah, story.
We have to change actually the name of our show to story. Well, okay, but even then...
I think we'll start a panel.
There we go. Oh, yeah.
A panel for conventions. We'll just travel the convention circuit. We'll do the story panel.
I think that's a good idea. Maybe more people should pay attention to it.
There we go.
But story doesn't always save you. John Carter had a great story.
Yes.
Ender's Game. Ender's Game is a fine adaptation of the source material. Did not resonate with audiences.
Well,
And yeah, it's, and there were some
Ender's Game.
There were social issues around it too, but still.
I think Ender's Game is an outlier because of all of the stuff with Orson Scott Card and the politics.
Yeah, to some degree, yeah. But you know, you and I both know there's a huge chunk of the audience that just doesn't care about that stuff. They don't pay any. People go to Michael Bay movies.
But Michael Bay isn't a political figure. Politics and religion.
He makes garbage.
Connected.
He makes garbage.
I know, but when you consider that Orson Scott Card is outspoken both on politics and religion, and the internet is the place where the loudest people complain the most.
Well, and true,
you combine those two things, you manage to lose a
lot of the fans, a lot of the science fiction fans paid attention to that, and
I think a lot of the outside fandom people paid attention to that as well, because Facebook became the big echo chamber for all of that, and just bounced back and forth around.
Yes, this is true, but at the same time, you and I, we've made a Lovecraft movie. We know that H.P. Lovecraft was like a good chunk of the populace of the United States in the 1920s a racist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, some of it was endemic. It was built into the culture, but that doesn't change the fact that he's basically the guy who cracked open American horror,
right?
I'm not a fan of Card's politics or his beliefs or any of these things, but Ender's Game is one of the finest science fiction books ever written. And the first few Alvin Maker books, I lost interest in that series. I hated the fact that I lost interest in that. His books don't have his politics.
It's like David Weber, with the Honor Harrington books. Mm-hmm. You know, there are characters in there, from all the different political mm-hmm. stripes. And I think that's the best way to do it, is you present a mix.
Sure.
Because that's how you make a good story.
Mm-hmm.
Is you have different philosophies and different points of view from your different characters.
But I mean, even the production team on Ender's Game was very vocal about the fact that the director was like, I don't agree with him.
Yeah.
This is a great book. We made a great movie based on a great book. You know? And he's already been paid, so you're not giving him any more new money, guys.
Right.
So, but it didn't sink in for whatever reasons. It didn't resonate. So we're not going to get another Ender movie. But at the same time, it's a solid adaptation of one of the important books in science fiction. Whether you agree with his politics or not, you disagree with or agree with his worldview.
I think Ender's Game, and this could be something that we could talk about on another episode. The how much Ender's Game now. Probably would still. I think Ender's Game probably would resonate even more now because how many kids are playing video games?
Well, not only that, but we actually have child soldiers in parts of the world that we hear about this stuff. This is stuff that we weren't even hearing about years ago. That there are kids out there who are being forced to fight in wars as children. I mean, small children who are learning how to kill.
What was I seeing? Wasn't there aren't they now talking about doing some virtual reality simulators that actually do pretty much similar to what Ender's Game actually did in fiction?
It wouldn't surprise me.
Stuff now that's real.
Oh yeah. And so it's
crazy.
That's definitely something we could look into. And I think that in the meantime, people can go watch films like Ender's Game or John Carter. Watch John Carter.
Yes.
Because it's a very, very good film and with a terrible ad campaign.
Yes, and we actually have some articles about why you should watch why you should watch John Carter.
That's right.
On our website, which is scififorme.com, which is where you can find all of the latest headlines and the things what we write about. And if you have thoughts on anything that we write about or conversate about here on any of our podcasts, you can leave us a comment, or you can join us over on the social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, Google+, Tumblr, and YouTube. And we also have an email that you can send us notes through. It's h2o@scififorme.com, or you can call our hotline, which is 573-42-SCIFI. And if you are a very solid fan of these podcasts, if you really like to hear us do our thing here, we do have a support group for you. that's what we'll call it. We'll call it the Sci-Fi For Me Radio Support Group.
Because there is no cure.
That's right. Yes, we're sorry. so we have started a campaign over at Patreon, which is basically a way of building our resources so we can do more, better, faster of all of the different things that we do. So it's patreon.com/sci-fi-for-me. You can make a pledge. You can donate and help us expand our reach, expand our coverage of the different events and the conventions and the things that we do here. We will link to that from our show page. And that's going to do it for us this time out. Episode 76 in the can. We're heading very quickly toward 100.
I was just thinking that very thing.
Yeah, it's going to be here before we know it. We're going to have to do something special for it. Maybe talk to Superhero Stuff about doing a giveaway, maybe. All right, on that note, yes, go visit superherostuff.com.
Oh, yeah, great stuff.
And come back next week for another episode of H2O.
This has been a presentation of scififorme.com. Copyright 2015 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is Sci-Fi For Me Radio.